Hello, LawPod listeners. I have an appropriately dark subject for you in the dead of winter. Pollution, or more specifically, the poisons in our environment and the lawsuits that follow. Remember the US attorney Erin Brockovich and her struggle to expose the harm done by the emission of toxic substances. That film wasn't about the criminal law, but the role of civil claims to monitor and deter environmental damage. I have with me today two experts in pollution, and as it happens, my role in this episode is simply to introduce them. David Hart, KC of One Crown Office Row, has a practice covering a range of issues in environmental law, including water and contaminated land. David will be talking to Roy Harrison, Professor of Environmental Health at Birmingham University. Roy is a specialist in the effect of source emissions through atmospheric and physical transformations in the environment. Both he and David Hart recently spoke at a conference on environmental toxic torts held by the Toxicology Group of the Royal Society of Chemists, a meeting which brought scientists and lawyers together to explore current perspectives on environmental toxic tort claims and to review recent cases. I now hand you over to David.
Welcome, Professor Roy Harrison, to this podcast. You and I were at a conference recently, as Rosalind has said, about toxic torts, and you spoke about two cases, both involving claims in Africa. And I wanted to talk with you about those particular cases. The first case you spoke about involved Kabwe in Zambia. It was a town where there was a long history of lead mining and smelting, and proceedings were brought by local people affected by that. And there were well over 100,000 people affected. You were the expert instructed, and indeed still are instructed by the applicants. Could you just talk us through your task and your broad findings in that case?
Yes, indeed. Pleased to do so. Kabwe is, I think, almost unique for its very high degree of lead pollution. And this arises from a mining and smelting activity in the Zambian town, which has caused a very long-term contamination phenomenon with high levels of lead. And the issues at stake were whether the industrial activity was in fact responsible for the very high levels of lead contamination of the local environment, and also whether the time period over which the plant was actually operated or controlled by the Anglo-American company was responsible for a substantial amount of that contamination, because the plant operated from the early 20th century and Anglo bought into it when it was already operational, and it was taken over from them by the Zambian government when the country became independent. So they didn't operate it for the entire period. But there were production records that showed the amount of lead production for which they were responsible. The local soils are very heavily contaminated with lead, and this was some of the hardest scientific evidence that there had been some high-quality surveys of lead in soil. And lead is pretty immobile in soil, so once it gets there, it tends to stay there. So what's in the soil now is a record of what's been there over a long period. And that lead footprint is very consistent with what we would expect for arising from emissions from the lead smelting works, which was the works operated over much of its lifetime by Anglo-American. The levels of lead, as I say, were very high, and the geographic distribution, when you took account of the wind frequencies, showed very much a pattern of downwind deposition of lead, which is what you would expect from a major point source. The experts for Anglo did put forward an argument that perhaps a lot of this lead arose from natural mineralization. So that's naturally rich lead deposits, which of course there were underground, because that's why the smelter was there, because it started off with a mine and the products of the mine were smelted on site. But there was evidence from the literature that if you looked at the depth profile of lead in the soil, that it was very much enriched in the surface layers, which is what you would expect had it come in from the atmosphere, so from the emissions from a chimney from the smelter, as opposed to having come up from the bottom, as it were, from underground deposits, in which case you would expect to see probably higher concentrations at depth or a fairly constant profile with depth. And it wasn't there. It was very much a surface enrichment. So the evidence was hugely strong that the contamination had arisen from the smelter. Now, the complaint of the litigants was based on objective measurements of blood leads, and particularly those of children. And lead is very harmful to young children. It causes a retardation in intellectual development. It's less serious in adults unless the exposures are massively high. And the blood leads are an indicator of fairly recent exposure, typically exposure in the last month or so. And these were highly elevated in a number of surveys going on over a number of years and are elevated to the current day. And Anglo or their experts tried to argue that the plant was particularly badly operated by the Zambian government company after it was nationalized. And indeed, there is some evidence of considerable problems then. But the evidence from the blood lead surveys and from the soil leads indicated that the lead contamination went back over a much, much longer period and that this wasn't just a recent phenomenon. So we were able to put together what I hope is a convincing case. It's still sub judice, but I hope it will convince the court, not only that the lead smelter was very much the predominant local source of lead, but also the period when the defendants were actually responsible for or were operating the plant themselves was responsible for a very large proportion of that lead in the soils. And we were able to integrate the amount of lead in the soils and compare it with some of the company's records for losses, because they knew what was going in the ores, they knew what was coming out in produced lead and in waste materials like slags. And there was quite a lot of lead unaccounted for. And unfortunately, that's what was going out through the chimneys and contaminating the local environment. And I was able to show through crude calculations that much of that lead is in the local environment, including local townships, causing much of this exposure to local people. And the blood leads in the children are very consistent with what you would expect from those levels of lead in the soils.
Roy, that's very helpful indeed. That really sums up the case. And I thought what I would now do is add a little bit of legal context to this claim and similar claims. And the first question which our listeners may be saying to themselves is, well, it's a claim involving Zambia. Why is it brought in South Africa? And there are a number of potential answers to that question. The first is that's where Anglo American is, this company is domiciled. The second is that the South African courts recently have evolved a form of procedure to allow claims to go forward as long as those claims are certified by a judge as a class action. The judge thereafter will decide things, generic issues like how much lead in the soil comes from the Anglo's period, etc., etc. But at the early stage, and this is the important bit, it's very easy and relatively economic to get a class action going because the proceedings are on an opt-out basis, i.e. everybody with lead in their blood is included in the class. They can opt out if they don't want to join in. It means that you can process 100-odd thousand people without the palaver of getting them all to sign up to a particular agreement and join the action in a formal sense. And once the judge has decided the generic issues, the central issues, then the individual claims go ahead and the individuals join on an opt-in basis. Currently, the proceedings have not got terribly far as I can see from the records. The application for class certification was made in January 2023. It was fought root and branch by Anglo, and now everybody appears to be waiting for the judge to make up his or her mind as to whether it is to be certified. So that's the first case. I should say that there is no automatic equivalent in English law to class certification. The closest there is a group litigation order system. And the difference being there that everybody has to opt in and sign up to proceedings. And we'll see an example in our second case of exactly where that had happened. Just to give you an insight as to how complicated that can be, there is a group litigation order currently rumbling through the British courts concerning the Mariana dam burst in Brazil, where there are some 732,000 people signed up. So let's go to our second case. It's a mere flip of 4,000 miles across Africa to Côte d'Ivoire and Abidjan. It's a claim about naphtha sludge, which ended up in Côte d'Ivoire. And the claims were against Trafigura in respect to fumes when this waste was dumped. Again, this is a case, Roy, where you were an expert involved, and perhaps you can summarise what it was all about.
Yes, I was one of many expert witnesses on this particular case. The defendants are a company called Trafigura, who are a major trader in commodities, including oil and oil products. And one of their individual traders had the idea that they could improve the quality of naphtha, which is a crude oil fraction, by mixing it on a ship with sodium hydroxide. This is not conventional. There are procedures that can be carried out in the refinery to do this, but this was a shortcut to producing a cleaned up naphtha, which could then be marketed as a motor fuel. The downside to this is that the sodium hydroxide takes up a large proportion of the sulfur compounds from the oil, and it produces a very unpleasant slop because the sulfur compounds are particularly malodorous and in sufficiently large exposures are highly toxic as well. The ship attempted to unload these toxic slops, I believe it was in the Netherlands, and was declined by the receiving company, who didn't want to take this particular cargo. And the ship then set sail for Abidjan in the Ivory Coast, where a local company with tanker lorries took on board 16 very large road tankers of 35 cubic meter capacity each, which firstly set off for the local rubbish tip to try and discharge their content there. These slops were extremely malodorous, and when a modest amount had been discharged there, the local people refused to let any further lorries in. And so the drivers of these tanker lorries took them to various other points in the city, where they either discharged them into drains or directly into watercourses. And as a result of this, the compounds, the chemical compounds, the sulfur compounds within the slops tended to mix into the atmosphere. And this led the whole city to smell pretty foul, bad egg type smell, for about a month. And so one of the aspects in which what I was involved was trying to estimate the rate at which these toxic compounds would leave the sodium hydroxide and mix into the air, which was some chemical calculations, and then how they would disperse in the atmosphere and what the resultant concentrations were. And then this was taken on by the toxicologists and other medical experts to provide interpretation of what effects on health might have occurred.
So that was the case. And as I've said, it was run via a group litigation order in the United Kingdom. And again, that was for a number of reasons, but not least because Trafigura UK was domiciled there. So we had a defendant you could attack here and get his money if you had to. And the solicitors involved, Lee Day, who were involved in the first case, are also based in the United Kingdom and have long experience of this sort of case. More pertinently, they could take the case on a no-win, no-fee basis, and that was never going to work in the Côte d'Ivoire system. So everything rather pointed towards things being issued here. In the end, some 29,000-odd claimants signed up on the dotted line. The case rumbled on and was settled not far off trial for £30 million plus costs. The joint statement put out by the parties after the settlement is actually, for once, really quite revealing. It basically says that many of the worst fears of the claimants were not borne out by the expert evidence. There was a good deal of anxiety about deaths, miscarriages, stillbirths and the like, but there was no medical evidence linking that to the fumes. What people had to put up with was a ghastly time, headaches and the like, but lasting a relatively short period of time. So that's the second case. And now I'm now going to really let you off the leash, because I'd like to ask you about what are your big research interests at the moment and recently.
My research interests are varied, but they centre on airborne particles. And it's something I've been interested in more or less since I started my research career, but it's become a massively topical subject because airborne particles are responsible for the largest part of the adverse health effects of air pollution exposures, a very large part of it. And also, they play a major part in the regulation of climate. We do need to understand them very fully if we're going to have better models that predict current and future climate. So airborne particles are a fascinating subject. I'm interested in road traffic because it's a major source of emissions of particles. I'm interested in much more esoteric sources, such as formation from gases released from the oceans, which are actually quite important in polar areas. And we've done work on icebreaker ships looking at processes in polar areas, my research team has. But there's actually quite a lot of generic fundamental understanding that we get from looking at these very different environments. So we work in places as diverse as the Antarctic and Delhi, where one can only go to Delhi for a limited period because it really is quite risky to the health of people who are not used to breathing those levels of air pollution. I also have been heavily engaged over a very long time in providing scientific advice to government departments. And I think one of my claims to fame is that I chaired a review group for the forerunner of DEFRA, reported back in 1993, which is now rather a long time ago, on the implications of increased sales of diesel passenger cars. And it warned about the problems that we were going to have with particles from diesels and also nitrogen dioxide from diesels. And the particle problem has been to a large degree resolved, not totally, but to a large degree it's been resolved by the fitting of filter traps on diesel vehicles. So all new diesels have had them since 2011. So there's not a lot of diesels on the road that don't now have those filter traps. But the nitrogen dioxide problem lingers to the present day. And although the technologies on the very latest vehicles provide a very high level of control, there's still a very large proportion of diesels on the road that emit large amounts of oxides of nitrogen, which lead to high nitrogen dioxide exposures. So we're interested in that, interested in the environment within the car and whether things like cabin air filters are effective and how we can limit our exposures. So that's a snapshot of current research interests. But I've ranged a long way, and I did a lot of work many years ago on lead pollution when it was a major issue before we took lead out of fuel. And actually some of the results from that early work, studies on a lead smelter which was running at Avonmouth in the UK, some of the results from that were actually quite useful in interpreting the data from Cabway.
Roy, that's very helpful and very interesting. I happen to note, looking at one of your CVs, that you've been involved in the writing of some 660 peer-reviewed papers. So I think we've probably covered in about 5 or 6 minutes that very effectively indeed. With many thanks to you, I shall invite Rosalind to wind up the session.
We've heard about a whole range of scientific and legal issues in this exchange between David and Roy. I hope they've convinced you as listeners that there are tools in the civil litigation box that help us to call polluters to account. But it's a deeply complicated process and requires persistence and considerable scientific expertise. We will be returning to this subject early next year. But in the meantime, enjoy the dying embers of 2023. But don't breathe the air too deeply. You never know what's in those molecules.